Okay, let's begin. So I did draw the cell membrane on here because I'm going to be kind of referring back to it. We'll get there. Yep. All membrane transport, organelles, cytosol, a whole bunch of them. So they'll be a kind of the next ones in the slide set. I did mix them up a little bit because I had them kind of a little bit out of order, but that's okay. They're still all in there what I'm going to use. So just a bit of a different order. But if you haven't opened up for a bit, I changed the order a bit today before I came to class. So, okay. This is still, this was the end of last week. Yes. Yes. Okay. Just a couple of things to remember in terms of the pictures here. When we're looking at membrane proteins, you know, when we're talking about these integral proteins and the different types, what's important to understand is that, you know, they can be an ion channel, which, you know, can be very particular to a certain ion. They can be a carrier, which what happens is when a certain substance comes up to it, the integral proteins kind of changes shape, thus squeezing the compound through either out of or into the cell as far as that goes. The integral protein receptor is kind of important. And ligand is a word that you do need to remember. So the ligand has the ability to alter the integral protein to accept something. In other words, change shape to accept such thing. So, for example, of course, insulin, when there's too much glucose in the blood, insulin gets released. You have certain integral proteins that are, they have receptors on the one end that is sensitive to or responds to the actual insulin hormone itself, and when the two come together and meet, so when the insulin and the insulin receptor or the ligand, when they come together, then there's conformational change to the integral protein, and which allows the very large glucose molecule to pass through, remembering that the glucose molecule is an extremely large water-soluble compound, therefore it cannot just simply pass through the membrane because it's a water-soluble compound, okay? There are a couple of different types, of course. Any protein can act as an enzyme, and as we talked about last week, enzymes are, they do influence the speed at which chemical reactions occur to change something into something else, depending on what we're after. Without enzymes, changes, chemical changes can occur, but they would be so slow that the cell would not be able to respond appropriately, nor the organism. So we need enzymes to facilitate faster chemical reactions to produce things in the body itself. Again, remember I keep saying it's all about proteins, right? Proteins, enzymes are proteins. Everything's about proteins. And then, of course, we have anchors which hold it together. I won't be asking any questions on that. And I'm not going to talk about anything other than these cell identity markers, these glycoproteins. They're the ones, as I said, that the body has the ability to kind of look at every cell in your body and recognize that it belongs there or it belongs to you. Hence the reason why if you have a heart transplant and you have somebody else's heart, those integral proteins or those glycoproteins on that new heart will not be the same ones that you have. Okay? So, yes. Sir, what did you say? The linkers, just understand that there some of these integral proteins do help hold the membrane together. If you have a heart transplant, then the glycoproteins on the cells on that heart aren't the same as what yours are in the rest of your body, which could, under circumstances, any circumstance, elicit an immune response, and your immune system would look at those markers on those cells no differently than it would COVID or any other virus that's kind of coming along saying, okay, we've got an invader, we need to kill it because it's not doesn't belong here. Okay? Yes. That's the glycoproteins. That's the cell identity glycoproteins. No, the glycocalyx is the sugar coating. So again, think of it as an M&M's. That these glycoproteins and the sugar molecules help form a shell around the membrane to some degree. That is correct. An invader could be identified on quite a number of variables depending on what that invader is, any type of bacteria, they're different, and viruses tend to be different. So this is why Everybody remembers what a COVID molecule looks like now, right? I'm sure you've seen it many times in the media. What's it look like? It's a spiky ball. You know what those spikes are made of? Protein. Okay? Right? So it's those spikes that we try to get your immune response to recognize before the virus takes hold and starts to divide and, shall we say, take over when you get sick. So the whole purpose of those COVID shots are they take pieces of those spikes and kind of, if you had like a bloodhound and you're looking for someone and you put someone under the nose to have a sniff of, right, to get the scent. Same idea is when you get that vaccine for COVID, all it's doing, it's giving your immune system a bit of a sniff of what that COVID kind of looks like, so that when it comes in, it goes, I know who the hell you are, you don't belong here. And boom, you get an immune response and it's hopefully destroyed before you even recognize that you even got ill. How many people here have had a positive TB test, even though you've never had TB? Anybody? Yes. You don't know, maybe some of you don't know yet. Okay, but some of you may find that you do. You're going to test positive for TB, and you're like, I never have TB. All that means is that you've come across TB. Your body has recognized it and probably fought it, and you didn't get ill from it, but it's been left behind in your immune signature. And when you get the TB test, it sometimes shows up that, oh, you came across it at some point because there's a change in your immune system to deal with it if it comes along again. Okay, peripheral proteins. So those are the integrals. Remember, integrals are all about passing through the cell membrane from outside to inside or inside to outside. Peripherals are found, though, on both surfaces. Now, I only drew it on the external surface here because I drew something else in there for, which is going to come up shortly, but they do sit on the surface. They are more common on the cytosol side, which would be this bottom part of the cell membrane, and their function is enzymes. So they're all about influencing chemical reactions. With some integral proteins, they can provide attachment for protein filaments found in the cytosol and give or help provide strength. So you can see these little stringy things here in the bottom. And we haven't talked about that yet, but that's what we call the cytoskeleton. So these are protein filaments that kind of provide some anchoring or some strength to the shape of the cell. And quite often, those filaments do attach to the cytosol. Peripheral proteins for anchoring and holding together. There are some integral and peripheral proteins which can act as receptors on the cell surface for recognition, as we've already talked about. Nearly all the integral proteins and a good number of peripherals have a carbohydrate attached to them, so therefore they're known as a glycoprotein. So the minute there is a carbohydrate group attached, which are a specific type of sugars, which are these little five-sided things that I have drawn here. We have a glycolipid here, which is attached to the phosphate head here of the membrane, and we also have one here that attaches to the peripheral protein, so therefore it would be a glycoprotein. And glycoproteins, along with glycolipids, do help form the glycocalyx. Hence the reason why they're sort of part of the identity as far as that goes. Yeah. Usually, it usually attaches more to a peripheral protein because it may get in the way of the normal function of an integral where you may have a ligand receptor there or something like that. Okay, the bilipid layer, this whole makeup here of the phosphate heads and the fatty acid tails, remember, hydrophobic in the middle and hydrophilic on the outside, it makes what's called a fluid mosaic, meaning the lipids create a lipid liquid in which the proteins float around. So these integral proteins, as much as they're solid in the drawings, they're always floating around and changing their position in the cell membrane up to 10 million times per second. Okay? Allows for lipid and protein molecules to change their positions within the membrane structure, of course, depending on what's going on in the environment of the cell itself or what the cell is required to do. There, obviously, these cellular membranes do have various functions. One is to create an electrochemical difference between inside and outside with ions. So we, like I said, we have positively charged ions and we have negatively charged ions. And under normal circumstances, for example, when a muscle cell is said to be in the relaxed state, right, it's more positive outside than inside. And that has to do with the accumulation of ions one side or the other of the cell. And how are those ions kept at the particular levels that are required? The integral proteins are either pumping out or pumping in ions to maintain what's called a gradient difference. So that one side of the cell membrane in this case would be negative and the other side is positive. It's no different than your car battery, right? You have two poles on your car battery. One is positive and the other is. And without a positive and negative, you don't get a charge. Same thing with cells. Okay, we must have that difference, and it's called a gradient difference. So there's a gradient difference of percentage, and that's what allows charge to happen. And that charge is required for nerve impulses, muscle contractions, heart muscle contractions, and so forth. Without them, we couldn't function. The second is, of course, this can act as a communication vehicle between cells. So sometimes the cell membrane is, I've got cells kind of packed together, and they talk to each other through these membranes and these alterations. Ultimately, a cell membrane, its most important function is to regulate what goes into the cell and what comes out of the cell. That's its whole role. What goes in, what comes out. Okay? So, with that in mind, our next discussion. Oops, wrong one. Is membrane transport. So, because things do cross one way or the other, we have to discuss the various types of membrane transport that can occur. Some of this is going to remind you of what happened there. Oh, that's all about. Don't know what happened there. Here we go. Okay. Some of this is going to take you all the way back to grade 9 biology. Sorry, can't find it? It's there. No, because I moved it. No, you're in the wrong one. No, we're in week 2. Keep going. Organelle, cytoplasm, membrane transport. There you go. Okay. Okay, so we talked about how the membrane really controls what goes in and what goes out. In other words, things pass through the membrane one way or the other. A number of compounds move across the membrane, and of course, we need that for normal health, both of the tissues that the cells sit in and the cells themselves as far as that goes. Now, things can pass through the membrane either actively or passively. Okay? So when we say passive, it is movement of compounds down the concentration gradient or electrical gradient, and both of these use the compound's kinetic energy, which is the movement of the particles that make up the compound, and no energy is required. So let's think of a beaker. We have a nice tall beaker of distilled water. It's clear, you can see through it. And I'm going to put 5 drops of green food coloring in. What is going to happen? Okay. Okay, so it will get green and greener, right? So they compare to what it was. So what happened there? Yeah, well, we're not going to get there yet. Just what happened? So when I put those drops of dye in the beaker, was there more dye in the dye or in the water? More dye in the dye. And there's really, virtually, when you put the first few drops in, there is no dye in the water. Okay, so because we have a great amount of dye in the dye and no dye in the water, there is a gradient difference, isn't there? There is more in the dye than there is in the water. So because there's more and less, it's going to go down the gradient. So the dye is going to move from a high concentration to a low concentration. So when you put that dye initially in the beaker of water, that dye is a very strong green, correct? Okay, so when you put the dye in the beaker of water, how strong is that green? Is it more or less than the dye? as it works its way around the beaker of water. So when I put the two or three drops of green dye in the beaker of water, and we give things a chance to kind of, shall we say, mixy mix, right? Is that water as green or less green than the dye that went in? Yeah, right. So what happened? It's not confused. Yeah. Okay. So when the compound moved from high concentration down to low concentration, it used kinetic energy. In other words, the energy that exists in what the compound is made of to move around the beaker. Now that green dye has no tail, feet, arms, legs. There's no electrical current moving it around. So how the hell did it make the whole beaker go green? The kinetic energy actually continues to drive the dye down the concentration gradient. It will continue to move in the areas of water where there is no dye, because even if it looks less, there's still more in the green water than there is in the clear water, correct? So it'll all move to try to move down and fill up the whole thing with green. Well, there's a couple different types of passive. I'm just getting the idea that there's no ATP or anything that's used to move it around. It just moves on its own kinetic energy. But what I really want you to take away is that it moves down.
Does that have to move the kinetic energy of the solution that it's in, like just the kinetic energy of?
No, it's the kinetic energy of the compound itself. Because those particles, if it was water you were using, depending on what your comp,
so
play, right?
So your analogy, it's not just the green, dye.
It is, because you've got a background and you're making it complicated. I'm trying to make it very simple. You're not incorrect, right? There is an interaction with charge that does cause it, right? But what we're after just now passively is moving down the gradient, moving with just kinetic energy. No, it's okay. It's a great question, but.
And it specifically has to be down, like you would never move up the gradient?
Not passively. Right, but we'll get to actives later.
Right.
Okay? So yeah, passively is always moving down from high to low. Okay? So passive is the movement of compounds down the concentration gradient or electrical gradient, and both of these use the compound's kinetic energy, movement of the particles that make up the compound, and no energy is supplied. Active movement, cellular energy is used to drive the compound up the gradient. So, in other words, if we were to use an analogy, in passive, you're in the canoe floating down the river, having a couple of beers, don't have to paddle or anything, the current's taking you down. Active movement across the membrane is like trying to paddle the canoe up against the current.
Would it never go down? It'll always be up? Because it's going against something?
Oh, that's a much more complicated answer. Remember that question. Well, we will answer it in its own kind of way, all right? Right. Well, yeah, but you have to understand. So if I'm paddling that canoe against the current, what happens when I stop paddling? Right. So if I'm going against the concentration gradient, it's always wanting to move down. So hence, I need energy to move against the gradient because it's going up. Everybody follow? We're going to explain this a whole lot more, trust me, a whole lot more. Okay? Yes,
okay.
Depending on what's required. Homeostasis, right? Always kind of doing this, right? Passive is passive. We just use kinetic energy. When we're using active, when we're talking about active movement across the membrane, we require an energy source. And that energy source for everything in the body that is energy is ATP, adenosine triphosphate. When we get to the Krebs cycle, I love the Krebs cycle. I love the Krebs cycle. ADENOSINE. Okay? So, phosphate. So, okay, everybody got that? Okay, all right. So, let's do passive first. So, these are the things that can happen without energy. First is diffusion, and everybody kind of got the idea with the green dye in the beaker, right? So, this is the mixing of particles that occurs because of the particles' kinetic energy. Both the solute and the solvent undergo diffusion. Okay? So, What that means is, and the question was asked earlier, is that there will be an interaction both of the water and the dye. Everybody is doing the dance because it wants to achieve equilibrium so that there is equal amounts of dye and water throughout the entire beaker. So there's never any point in the beaker where it's a little more green here and a little more water there. Everything is kind of doing its thing. So when we put the dye first in the water, you can start to see that the dye is starting to spread out in the beaker. But eventually you'll get to a point where you won't see any movement at all. So this is when we have equal parts of water and dye, but they're not still. They are ever shifting. They're always changing. But the thing to take away is that things moved down the gradient. So if one area of the solvent contains greater amounts of the solute will move towards the area of lesser solute. So maybe for some of you, how many people don't know what a solvent and a solute is here? Or does everybody kind of remember that? So the solvent is, right, the water. And the solute is the dye. Okay, now you have to be careful because some people say, well, the solute's solid and the solvent's liquid. And no, it doesn't always work that way because sometimes both are liquid, all right? So the water was the solvent and the dye was the solute, okay? So it's always moving towards the lesser part until we reach equilibrium. This is known as movement down the gradient. So the dye was moving from its concentrated area to a less concentrated area until the entire beaker is equal parts water and dye. Everybody follow me? Okay. And the dye became less and less green because what was happening? Right. So in the dye, the compound that makes up the dye, all those little particles, they're tightly packed together in the dye, right? That's why it looks so green. When it goes in the water, those particles start to separate so much that the water is still green, but it's only a light green because those particles are so far apart in the beaker, right? Eventually, the particles will become equally distributed in the solution. If we place a membrane between the two solutions and one side has a greater number of solute, these particles will want to move across that membrane using kinetic energy to try to equalize both sides. So what the heck does that mean? Because whenever I learned about diffusion and osmosis when I was in high school, they'd say, well, we're going to put a semipermeable membrane across the beaker, and we'll get this kind of movement. I'd be like, what the frick is a semipermeable membrane? I had no idea what that is, right? So now you have one right here. That is a semi-permeable membrane. So if, by chance, on this side, I'm not going to put the plus signs in. It'll take all night. Okay, what do we got there? Yep, on what side? More than the other. There is hydrogen on both sides, but according to this, if we place a membrane between two solutions and one side has a greater number of solute, those particles will want to move across the membrane using kinetic energy to try to equalize both sides. So what direction would the hydrogen want to move here? To the other side, to the bottom of the blackboard, correct? Why? Right, because there's less hydrogen on that side than there is on the other side, correct? Okay, so this is always happening in the human body, okay? But the thing is, we have to remember that this membrane controls what goes across, and we want it to. Because remember I talked about how when a muscle cell is, when it's relaxed, it's more positive on the outside and more negative on the inside, okay? We want to have a different gradient difference from one side to the other. That's what makes a functional normal cell. If hydrogen, which can kind of leak through here and want to get there because there's a greater amount, and so there's always leaking hydrogen to try to equalize, this is where integral proteins come into play, right? They will move hydrogen the other way, but that's for an active process a bit later on. But can you see how, with a membrane, at this point we have a greater number of hydrogen. We'll call this extracellular. Okay, and we'll call this intra. In other words, this is outside the cell, this is inside the cell. We're saying here, those hydrogen on that side want desperately to get to the other side because there's a difference. Even though there's a membrane there, the hydrogen knows there's less over there, so we need to get over there and equal things out. So far, so good? Okay. Two things influence the rate of this diffusion. The concentration gradient. The more hydrogen I put over here, the more that hydrogen wants to get to the other side. So if we have a massive gradient difference, so if there's a little bit, yeah, there's some movement, but if there's a big difference from one side to the other, that high side desperately has a lot of pressure to move to the other side, right? It wants to move across. Temperature. The hotter this gets, the faster that movement will occur. Does anybody know the ratio? Temperature and metabolic rates and movements. For every degree Celsius more is 10 times faster metabolic processes or chemical processes occur. Okay, how long does it take to cook rice in cold water? In cold water? Maybe a month? Maybe? Right? So this is why we heat boiling water to make things like rice, because it speeds up the rice's ability to soak up the water, because we've applied heat to have the chemical process of water and rice getting together to happen so much faster. No, that's probably just a typo on my part. Yeah. Now, the mass of diffusing substance, of course, the larger it is, the slower it's going to take. Right, and we know that because we talked about glucose, for example, being a very large molecule. If it has a harder time getting through the membrane, it's going to move across slower. For every degree Celsius, 10 times the rate of change. No, I'm just giving you. This is why, just as a little, again, back pocket thing, having been sick last week, this is why fever is a good thing. So fever actually speeds up your ability to fight whatever it is that's bothering you. When I went to school, I went to the Canadian College of Massage and Hydrotherapy. I was actually trained in giving a patient a fake fever by putting them in, you know, a steam bath or something like that in hopes to speed up some metabolic rates to help them fight disease, like sickness, that kind of stuff. Okay? Surface area, of course, the greater the surface area, the more movement we're going to get. And how far this compound needs to go is also going to affect how quickly it can or cannot cross the membrane. But ultimately, if there's lots of stuff on one side of the membrane, it really strongly wants to get to the other side. In other words, molecules do diffuse in all directions. Don't get me wrong, when we put that dye in the beaker, it diffused throughout the entire beaker in all directions. But when you're dealing, of course, with a membrane, which is really controlling how that compound moves, well, it's always moving from high concentration to low concentration. And I call these kind of the universal laws of human physiology. And what's really cool from a human physiology perspective is that the body utilizes these laws to its advantage. So we have a passive way of moving things across a cell membrane to either leave a cell or get into a cell. So the body utilizes the rule of diffusion as one example for things to cross the membrane and either get into or out of a cell. Once evenly distributed, it's called equilibrium. So you can't get equilibrium on both sides. We're going to learn when we're taking the electron transport chain, which is part of the Krebs cycle. Somebody's smirking because he now remembers it. That hydrogen is deliberately pumped on one side of a membrane to have a huge amount on one side compared to the other. And that's where we get our energy to create ATP. But we'll get into that later. There's a video there for you to watch. It may help you a little bit. Now, simple diffusion is substances moving freely across the plasma membrane. No transport molecules. So this includes nonpolar hydrophobic molecules, oxygen, carbon dioxide, nitrogen, fatty acids, steroids, fat, and soluble vitamins. There's one other compound that's fat soluble that can cross the cell membrane very, very quickly. And thank goodness it does, because you'd probably all be dead by now. And that is alcohol. If alcohol wasn't so able to so quickly cross the cell membrane, you'd drink a 26er of vodka and you wouldn't feel the effects of it for maybe 2 or 3 hours while it was slowly working its way. So this is why you can have a drink and feel it very, very quickly, because alcohol is fat soluble and it can easily slip through a cell membrane and affect change. All right? Fat soluble vitamins, A, D, E, and K, they can also cross cell membranes. And they're quite on the news right now, right? Their fat soluble vitamins are quite popular in the news in terms of taking them. But because they're fat soluble, again, they can cross the cell membrane quite easily. Oxygen and CO2, of course, is important. Steroids as well. Yeah, exactly what you're thinking about, testosterone and human growth hormone, all those sorts of things. They cross the cells very, very quickly as far as that goes. It gets kind of caught up and stuck a little bit because it's a bit more solid, but yeah, it's still somewhat fatty as far as that goes. Just now we're in a whole new world, hadn't talked about this before. If you happen to enjoy edibles, if you want to, because you know there's lots of problems you hear in the news where some individuals do edibles and it takes long for the effect to occur and they'll end up doing one or two more and then they get into trouble because they slowly accumulate. Some of the newest edibles are now adding fat soluble compounds, so the THC is absorbed much faster because it piggybacks on the fat soluble compounds and slips through the cell membranes far, far quicker. Yeah, WANA, WANA. Don't ask me how I know. Okay. Yeah. It crosses the cell membranes very, very quickly, and you don't have like the 45 minutes to an hour kind of wait.
Is that why fat-soluble vitamins are more dangerous?
Yes. No, they're more dangerous because they. So when you take any of the other vitamins that are non-fat-soluble, if you have too many, you just pee them out. Fat-soluble vitamins accumulate in the liver and can reach toxic levels and do very much harm. There's lots of articles out there that you can look at now that speak to, you know, people think, it may be recommended to do 1,000 international units of a, say, for example, vitamin D. And they'll do, well, maybe I'll do 10,000 just because, you know, I want to get a kickstart there. And they do that for an extended period of time, and then they end up with vitamin D toxicity, which is blindness, tinnitus, all sorts of things. So you have to be very careful with fat-soluble vitamins. They're not quite as, some people in here probably have very expensive urine. Because A, D, E, and K. Yep. Okay. Now, small uncharged molecules also pass through using simple diffusion. Water, urea, and small alcohols. The thing is that, you know, some of these things do take a bit of time to get across, but some things pass very freely through the membrane back and forth, which, again, the body utilizes to its advantage for any given sort of physiological processes. Solutes that are too polar, meaning more water-like, right, they cannot get through the membrane because of this area right here, the hydrophobic part. So solutes that are too polar or too highly charged can cross the membrane through facilitated diffusion. To facilitate means to what? Help guide transport, right? Okay. So they go by a different pattern. So the previous that are, sort of nonpolar in nature, they pass through the membrane quite easily. Those that are not, they're more polar, they require help. So integral proteins are the ones that assist in this. The first is called channel mediated. This is movement through a membrane channel. Most are ion channels, which allow inorganic ions that are too hydrophilic. For example, in the body, we have very specific ion channels. No one channels for all ions. Each ion has its own. So we have potassium, sodium and calcium. Okay? So when we get into muscle physiology or cardiac physiology, we're going to talk about sodium pumps and calcium pumps. Those pumps are just fancy words for integral proteins that are responsible for that specific ion. Okay? There's also a hydrogen one, hence the reason why I put hydrogens here, right? And it's responsible to pump hydrogen. But ultimately, they're an integral protein that is responsible to move these ions one way or the other, depending on what's going on. More than a million potassium ions can pass through a potassium channel in 1 second. Those are the kind of shifts that occur into and out of a cell membrane at any given time, depending on what's happening and what's going on. Yeah. Correct. Right. And we call those quite often pumps, but they're still that. Now, depending on what's going on here on either side of the membrane, we may have to open up this channel to allow to force ions one way or the other. Remember, though, we're still talking passive here, right? So this isn't actively moving anything up a gradient. This is just opening up to allow movement. So these do have little doors on them or gates that can open and close at any given time, depending on what the cell wants to have happen in terms of movement. So these are, again, our comp these are things that cannot cross a membrane very well. So it relies on integral proteins to move into or out of a cell, and gates on either end open or close, which allow that passive movement of those ions at any given time. Okay? And because the integral protein is helping or facilitating the ion to move across, it's called facilitated diffusion. Second is the carrier mediated. The solute binds to a specific carrier on one side of the membrane and is released on the other side through a change in shape of the protein. So quite literally, there's a carrier on it. The integral protein changes shape, forcing the compound to move again, either into or out of the cell, depending on what the movement is. This is still passive, and there's still no cellular energy used. Glucose, fructose, galactose, and some vitamins utilize carrier-mediated diffusion. And let's go with glucose. Of course, insulin allows glucose to enter into the cell through facilitated diffusion. So via the ligand, insulin attaches itself. I'll just put I here for insulin, just kind of a small n. It attaches itself here to the integral protein, thus opening it up for glucose to pass through the integral protein via facilitated diffusion to go into the cell. Now, I don't think I have it on here. No. So glucose, let's just say, just for lack of numbers, just to make it easier, we didn't have insulin and integral proteins, it might take a glucose molecule a minute to cross a cell membrane and get to the other side. With insulin and the interaction of the ligand on the integral protein, glucose can move into a cell, let's say, in a millisecond, which allows a quick change of glucose levels in blood. And that's how the body maintains glucose levels in blood. It, through insulin, it forces glucose into cells, thus lowering the amount of glucose in blood, maintaining the appropriate level of sugars in blood at any given time. Everybody understand that? Okay. Again, a video for you to watch. The next passive form, so those were diffusions, is osmosis. Now, osmosis has been called diffusion of water to even things up. So in diffusion, we were talking about solutes and solvents. When we're talking about osmosis, we're talking about the movement of water down a gradient. So it can be said that this is a type of diffusion where the solvent moves through a selectively permeable barrier. In normal human physiology, we're talking about water. It moves through the plasma membrane from high concentration to low concentration. Everybody follow me so far? Okay, it's water. So two ways. It can move between the phospholipid molecules, so water can move between those phospholipid molecules. I can just kind of do this. We'll just take one of these hydrogens. We'll call it H2O, and it will kind of wiggle its way into the cell via between these phospholipids. The other thing that can happen is integral proteins that function as water channels that are called aquaporins. So again, there's another specific integral channel in a cell membrane that's responsible for the movement of water. So as you now can see, remember I used the analogy of the soap bubble as a cell membrane kind of floating around? Now you can see the thousands of integral proteins that would penetrate through that membrane for water, ions, other things, right? There's a lot of integral proteins that are constantly controlling what goes in, what comes out of a cell at any given time. So aquaporins are a particular type of integral protein that's responsible for the movement of water. Water is moving down the concentration gradient. So the things that can drive it first is something called hydrostatic pressure. The more liquid on one side of the membrane increases pressure that causes the molecules of the liquid to move to the other side until equilibrium is created. So the more water there is on one side than there is the other, the stronger wants to move across that membrane so that there is equal amounts of water on one side of the membrane as compared to the other. So far, yeah? Okay. Yes? Right? The second is called osmotic pressure. And osmotic pressure of a solution is proportional to the concentration of the solute particles that cannot move across the membrane. The higher the concentration, the higher the osmotic pressure. So, you know Brian and his cooking, okay? How many people here ate eggplant? If you're doing eggplant properly, what should you do to your eggplant before you cook it? Especially the European way, especially European eggplants. Not so much Asian eggplants, they're a little creamier, but European eggplants are a little more dense. Sorry? No? No? You don't salt them? Now you know, don't you? Okay. In many traditional Italian recipes, because of the type of eggplant that's used in Europe, right, you slice the eggplant into thick slices, and you sprinkle salt on top of it, on both sides, and you let it sit. And what happens? What happens? Yeah. And sometimes it's almost black, right? So it draws moisture out of the eggplant. If you continue to leave that salt in too long, what will happen to the eggplant? It will shrivel up and get wrinkly, okay? So what happened there? So I've got an eggplant, I put salt on top of it, and lo and behold, all this water came out of it, even against gravity. So if I take the slice and I put it on the plate, and I put the salt on top, water will fight against gravity and come out of the eggplant. What's happening there? Not acidic. There is an environmental difference between the two. Osmosis. By placing salt on the outside of the eggplant, I have a greater concentration of solute outside the eggplant than I do inside the eggplant. So water wants to even things up, so it actually leaves the eggplant to even up the other side because there's much more solute outside the eggplant than in the eggplant. I guess to some degree it would. I guess you could say that you could do that. I'm just trying to think of an example in my mind that, you know, what would draw moisture out of the air. I would actually. The only time I could see that happening, because in so much as you think that, you know, air is humid, it's actually most cases it's not. It's not near as much as say in a plant or those sorts of things. But ultimately, by placing salt on the eggplant and having water come out, you are witnessing osmosis. Because the sheer fact you put salt on the eggplant means there's more solute outside the eggplant than inside the eggplant, and the water actually leaves the eggplant. Now, the reason they did that, just as a sidebar, is because quite often, quite a long time ago when we did eggplants, they're actually quite bitter. I don't know what Indian eggplants are like. I don't know if they have to be salted. They do have to be salted as well? Yeah. Okay, because they're a bit bitter, right? Yeah. Right. No. Right. So, yeah, so that water that comes out of the eggplant is actually a little bit bitter. So that gives you an opportunity to remove some of the bitterness before you cook it. You just did it. Didn't even think about it. Yeah. So the fluid coming out is actually you're witnessing osmosis. All right? Salt lamps? Yeah. Don't, yes. That's an entirely different philosophy. Edible? No, because it's energy that the salt lamps use. They. Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah, if it's really humid out, the salt will get wet because moisture in the air will try to attach to the greater density of the salt in the salt lamp. Yeah, that's about all they're good for. Maybe licking or grinding for a meal. It is. Yeah. Salt which? Yes. Yes. Okay, so salting a steak will do the same thing. Okay? Now, it used to be when I first learned how to cook was you never salted a steak. Because the idea was that you would draw blood out of it and make the fiber tight and it would make it tough. It's actually, they now know the exact opposite happens.
That's when you don't salt proteins first.
Right. Right, except for steak now. There's a different science now where some high chefs will take like a big cut of beef and salt the hell out of it and throw it in the fridge overnight. And it gets really firm and tight and it does tenderize it to some degree. So I know, it's kind of different. Who do? Oh, I love picanhas. Yep, and let it sit overnight, right? Yep. So, when we think about this from a human physiology point of view, we're salty, right? You know, the famous line is that humans carry the ocean on the inside. So if one believes through evolution that we came out of the ocean, so we initially lived in the ocean and we came out and we walk around and did whatever, and we decided that, you know, because we came out of the ocean, we needed to maintain a salinity. So therefore, inside, we are salty, right? So we have a high level of sodium, which is normal, which is what's required for our normal physiology inside. Yeah. Probably, yes, because of our disease state. Yeah. Yeah, it's part of the disease. Yeah, you'll get that in semester one with me in the fall. By the way, I'm teaching you guys Path Pathology 1 in semester one. So, under normal circumstances, osmotic pressure inside the cell is the same as the osmotic pressure outside of the cell. We don't want things moving inside and outside the cell. If that cell, with its amount of osmotic pressure inside the membrane, if that cell is placed in an environment where the outside of the cell is different in its osmotic pressure, the initial cell will change shape, thus changing the volume of the cell. This solution that the cell is placed in has a certain tonicity to it, the measure of the solution's ability to change the volume of a cell. In other words, if we take a red blood cell, and a red blood cell does float in water, blood has both solid and liquid attributes. You see blood as red. When you look at the red of blood, you are in fact actually looking at its solids, red blood cells. If we put that blood in a centrifuge and spun it around, you would see that all those solids would go down to the end of the test tube, and we would see a very kind of straw-colored liquid on the top, and that represents the water part of blood, right? Yes. Okay, well, so the straw part is, right? So, well, kind of. So, that fluid that red blood cell floats around in has a certain tonicity to it. In other words, under normal circumstances, the osmotic, there is no osmotic difference between the environment the red blood cell floats around in or the inside of the red blood cell itself. Okay? But what happens if it isn't? So, there are three types of solutions we can place a cell into. The first is called isotonic solution. But this solution, this isotonic solution, has the same osmotic pressure as inside the cell. Therefore, there will be no movement of water either into or out of the cell. Hence the reason why it's called isotonic, same. Okay? Sodium chloride, the saline solution, is used for when you have in an IV bag, it's isotonic for red blood cells. So we then would have to make sure that when we put a bag on someone and they have an intravenous, that solution, that sodium chloride solution that's going into their arms and into the bloodstream is the same tonicity as the blood cells. Okay? So there's a specific amount of sodium chloride in that solution, which means that there's no osmotic difference between inside the red cell and outside the red cell. Everybody follow me so far? No. Just the itself. Yep. If the solution has a lower concentration of solute as compared to the cytosol, water molecules enter the red blood cell faster than they can leave. The red blood cell will swell and it will burst. If the red blood cell has more solutes in it than the solution, in other words, we'll just call it salt. If the red blood cell has more salt in it than the solution, then the solution is going to move into the cell just simply because there's a greater amount of solute in there to the point that red blood cell can swell and burst. This is known as hemolysis. Yes, and highlight that, please, because you could ask questions on it, hemolysis.
This is like that, if you drink too much water.
Kind of, to some degree. Right. Okay. If the solution has a higher concentration of solutes as compared to the cytosol, the red blood cell, water molecules will leave the red blood cell at a faster rate than in, and the cell will shrink. So in other words, if the solution around the red blood cell is more salty than in the red blood cell, then water will leave the red blood cell to equalize outside the cell. Thus, the water will lessen inside the red blood cell, and it will shrink. And this is known as crenation. No, it just osmotically the water leaves the cell and just like the eggplant will shrivel up. Okay? So imagine the poor souls who, when they invented, you know, IV bags, and quite often possibly they weren't quite isotonic enough, and you would see alterations in red blood cell shape and size and so forth. So we can see here, you know, that the cell's 20% solute concentration of sodium in the water, and it'll kind of work. We can see here, this is, we can see isotonic here, so there's no change. We can see the biconcave shape of the red blood cells. They look quite nice. We can see here that all of a sudden we've put them in a hypertonic solution, meaning there's more solute outside the red blood cell than inside, and you see the red blood cell actually shrivels up until it gets all wrinkly and crinkly. That is known as crenation. And then in the third diagram, you can see the biconcave has disappeared. They've swelled right up because they're in a hypotonic solution, and the water goes in, and they'll, again, we'll get to a point where they'll eventually burst if they get full enough. Not much, I don't think. Are you talking directly in the lungs or just drinking it?
No.
You drown?
Sorry?
Why would you do that? What would be?
To get rid of the excess.
Yeah, so what you might be doing if you're putting a hypertonic solution in, then the mucus will leave the cells, and when you cough out the water, the mucus will follow. I'll give you a better example. So, How many, anybody here in the, any, unfortunately, have anybody in the family with kidney disease and they have to do dialysis? Okay. So you, do they do hemodialysis on the machine? No, but are, you know, is it hemo or, okay, so it, what kind, do they have dialysis? Do they do? Okay, so they use the bags. Right. Okay. So, and some individuals with kidney disease, of course, they go into hemodialysis, which is a machine that's like an artificial kidney. And it's supposed to, because your kidneys work this way, right? It's always moving water back and forth. So some individuals can't do a hemodialysis, and they have to do what's called peritoneal dialysis. So what they'll do is they'll have a bag with a solution going into one port in the stomach, and then in another port in the stomach, they'll have another tube that runs out and a bag that's 3 or 4 times larger. The bag that's up here at the top has a particular tonic amount to it, right? It actually is hypertonic. So as that solution travels into the peritoneum and surrounds all the organs in the gut, it draws fluid out of the organs plus all the toxins, and then all of that excess it draws out goes out the bottom port and fills up this bag at the bottom. So the bag that goes in is about this big. The bag that comes out is about this big. That's how much it works, right? It's quite significant. This is why we don't give salt pills when you're dehydrated and sweating. You just give salt pills because if you eat salt, which way is the water going to go? Into the body or out of the body? Out of the body into the gut. Okay. So again, we've got, you know, we need to maintain then these isotonic or these isotonic solutions, you know, so things function right between cells. The next movement is called filtration, and this is movement through a membrane due to hydrostatic pressure, and compounds pass through membranes not as a result of concentration differences, but rather pressure differences. And you guys have that probably every morning. What do you filtrate every morning? Coffee. You got it. Right? You use hydrostatic pressure. If you use like the, you know, the drip coffee, so the pressure of the water actually forces it through the coffee grounds, picking up little particles of coffee grounds, and hence the reason why the water is now dark and smells and tastes like coffee, along with the oils and all that kind of stuff. Let's take a break. We'll see you at the top of the hour. Okay, so that was our passive mechanisms. So now we have to do our active. So remember that passive mechanisms are all about generally, most of the time, going down the gradient and just allowing the normal movement of the relationship of solutes and solubles to move across. Active, of course, is going to fight up the stream or up the gradient. So active processes are required when certain solutes have to move up the concentration gradient. They're called active because we have to use cellular energy that within carrier proteins to move these solutes. Two forms of energy are used: ATP, which is the most common source of energy in the human body, and energy stored in an ionic concentration gradient. So the fact that there is a concentration gradient, more hydrogen here than here, actually does give us a charge. Now, in the case of what I've drawn on the board, hydrogen is written H positive, okay? So because there's more hydrogen at the top of the board than there is at the bottom, we say the concentration gradient is that that membrane is more positive on the top and more negative on the bottom, even though there are still positive hydrogen ions in the bottom. Everybody follow me? So because there's more hydrogen on the top, we say that it is more positive, and because there's less, it's more negative. Yes, but because there's more, this is considered to be more positive as compared to that with less. So this is considered to be more negative. Okay? So if we were to write it as positive negative concentration gradient, this would be written as lots of pluses, and this would be written as minuses, just simply because of the difference. Yeah, it would. Yes. So go ahead. No, but because there's less, the environment is more negative because there's less hydrogen as compared to the others. Okay. So Primary active transport uses ATP as an energy source that changes the shape of the integral protein that pumps a substance across the membrane. So there would be a conformational change to this integral protein, and it would start to move ions against the concentration. In other words, what we're seeing here on the board, this integral protein will continue to pump ions of hydrogen, even with that much still there. It'll still constantly make it higher. Now, we see that in a couple places in the human body. One is in the mitochondrial membrane when we're trying to get a higher concentration of hydrogen to create ATP. Another place we find it is within the cell in something called the lysosome, which is a digestive type of inclusion that's found in a cell, and hydrogen is pumped into it. In fact, what you find in a lysosome would dissolve iron girders in buildings if you had enough of it. It's highly, highly, highly high in hydrogen. Remember, it's against the concentration gradient. And, of course, you do need this carrier channel. It helps maintain the concentration differences, which is integral to the function of most cells. It's used to maintain an internal high potassium and a low sodium. Now, I use hydrogen here as an example, but we're going to get into this a lot more when we do muscle physiology and clinical anatomy in the second half, right? You have to remember what's happening here at any given time. The passive rules of diffusion would say that, right, we just think of diffusion for a moment, what direction does hydrogen want to move here? Right. So it is. It will leak through and it'll get there. But for this cell to do its normal function, say, for example, this is a muscle cell, it absolutely has to have a concentration gradient where there's more hydrogen at the top than at the bottom. So that always needs to be maintained. So in so much as diffusion is driving hydrogen down, the pumps are actively pumping it to maintain a higher concentration up here as compared to down here. Everybody follow? So that's always doing that. It's always working and doing that, okay? The secondary active transport involves concentration gradients as well. The sodium-potassium pump maintains a steep concentration gradient of sodium across the membrane, higher outside than inside. The excess sodium has stored or potential energy, and some of this is stored energy that can be diverted into kinetic energy when the sodium leads back into the cell. Because remember, through diffusion, you know, it's going to use kinetic energy to get back in because there's less sodium on the other side of the membrane. Okay? The kinetic energy can be used to move other substances against their concentration gradients. A carrier protein binds to the sodium, and another substance then changes shape so that all three can cross the membrane, thus getting it to cross over and create the greater gradient difference. So you may be asking yourselves at this point, what the hell has this got to do with massage? Okay, you're going to be taking pathology. You really have to understand how the normal function occurs. When we get into physiology, I'm going to be talking a whole lot about this stuff in terms of, for our case, it's going to be muscle cells, for example, cardiac physiology, how what happens at the cardiac cell that causes contraction, that kind of stuff. And then now when you get to, in third semester, you have a neuroanatomy class. So this is how nerve impulses are propagated throughout the body. It's how you're able to write letters that you're doing right now, blink your eyes, diaphragm contract, all those sorts of things. It's all done because this is happening, which is so important. So again, nice little video. It makes some sense to you. You can watch it there. And it may make things a little bit easier. So that was our actives. So now we have to have vesicular or vesicle transport. So cells can make things. And they, too, you know, if the cell makes it, that has to exit the cell. So not unlike what we were just talking about, this is another movement where we have membrane transport, that these things that are created in the cell need to get outside the cell. The other thing is, some cells, such as macrophages, they eat. So they have a process by which they grab things outside the cell and digest them. So how does that work? To think of the transport, first we have to talk about what a vesicle is. Now, a vesicle is a small spherical sac that can contain a whole bunch of different substances, sweat, oil, hormones, all sorts of things depending on what the cell is responsible for. These vesicles can transport between structures in the cell, so they can stay within the cell and move around, go here, there, and everywhere within the cell, or they can import materials into the cell, or release materials out of the cell, depending on what's going on here. So a vesicle can be used within the cell. A vesicle can be created when something is coming into a cell, and a vesicle can be used when trying to release something out of a cell. So the first is called endocytosis. Endo means what? Within, inside. So this would be things coming into the cell. This is the movement of materials into the cell in a vesicle formed by the cell membrane. There are three types of endocytosis. The first is called receptor mediated. So you hit, this is highly selective with specific receptors. The receptor protein in the membrane binds to a particle, then forms the vesicle. Low density lipoproteins, some vitamins, antibodies, and certain hormones use this to go into a cell. So there's a bit of a, what you would call a sort of a receptor that's sensitive to the compound, and when the two meet, the receptor gets stimulated, and then there's movement of the compound into the cell. Low density lipoproteins, bad fats. So these are the ones that can be related to heart disease and those sorts of things. Lipoproteins. No, LI. The next is called phagocytosis. To phago, or fag, is to eat. Cytosis means of the cell. So this is basically cell eating. Okay, so phagocytosis is cell eating. The cell engulfs large particles, such as worn-out cells, whole bacteria, or viruses. Only a few cells do this in the human body, and they are called macrophages and neutrophils. Collectively, they are known as phagocytes, and they're involved in the immune response. Okay? Now, macrophage, so we said phage is to eat. What's macro? Right? So a macrophage is a white blood cell that's a big eater. Okay, so what happens? We've got something that needs to be gotten rid of. So the particle binds to the membrane of the cell, then the membrane creates pseudopods, which are projections of the membrane. Do you guys remember this in science, in biology? Right, so you have, you know, something comes up to the membrane and these arms start to come up, these pseudopods, right, start to come up from the membrane. There's a change of the membrane, okay? Those pseudopods completely surround the particle, so these pseudopods come out and then they connect. Suddenly, what was just sitting against the membrane is now in the cell, right, forming a vesicle. So these pseudopods completely surround the particle, the membrane fuses, and then it forms a vesicle called a phagosome, the result of eating, okay? It's a vesicle of eating. Once in the cell, the phagosome fuses with the lysosome, which then releases enzymes to destroy the ingested material. Okay? So this is these macrophages are used very much in the immune response. Okay? In fact, how many people here have had a cut with pus? Really? Oh, so what is pus? Dead white blood cells, phagocytes that have surrounded a virus, and both have died and start to accumulate, and you get pus as a result of the normal immune response of the dying off of our immune system trying to kill whatever invader we have, bacteria or whatever. Yes, white stuff in the pimple is actually pus. Because you, when you get a pimple, your pore gets plugged with dirt, then you get a minor infection, and that dirt is invading, and you get an immune response. Hence the reason why the pimple gets all red and really tender on the outside. And then you get pus formation because the phagocytes and the immune response are fighting it out, and both are dying off, and you get accumulated dead debris, and it just starts to build up. And then you have to pop it. I was one of those unfortunate teenagers who had to see a dermatologist and had massively huge pimples all over my face and was not pretty. Yeah, I wore braces, had buck teeth, wore glasses, had pimples. I got lots of dates. Dr. Mazarol. Was it? Yeah. Yeah, she was. Now, the other type is called pinocytosis. Now, pino is liquid. So, phago is to eat. Pino is to drink. So, pinocytosis is known as cell drinking. So, tiny droplets of extracellular fluid are taken up. There are no protein receptors involved. Basically, the cell membrane folds inward, forms a vesicle, and pinches off. And again, lysosomes may come into this vesicle and release enzymes to break out anything that might be in there to break it into its further parts. So the body's a pretty amazing thing. You have this sort of stuff happening where a cell may eat something. It then gets broken down into its smallest components, and then the cell utilizes those. So it could be fats, it could be carbohydrates, and it could be amino acids. And then the body will reuse those things that it's dissolved to its own processes to build whatever. So, you know, you're thinking catabolism and anabolism happening at the same time in the cell, right? Yeah.
Where is the extracellular?
All around it. Every cell is surrounded by fluid.
Oh, but it's not like something's happened and that.
No. It's just stuff that may be floating around the fluid, and then the cell just kind of grabs it. Yeah. Okay, and again, a little video for you to watch. Now, endocytosis is bringing into the cell. Exocytosis was releasing things out of the cell. So, this is releasing material from the cell. All cells can perform exocytosis, but only phagocytes and... those other two cells can do endocytosis, right? Which was neutrophils and macrophages, correct. Okay? Whereas all cells can do exocytosis, can release whatever to the outside. And they absolutely have to, because cellular metabolism, the creation of things that a cell needs to create in order to survive, has byproducts as part of that process. So when the cell is building things to live its life, normal physiological processes, as a result of that, you get byproducts that are toxic, that can't build up in the cell. So the cell is just like you. You eat solid foods, and within a few hours, what do you got to do? Got to poop, because you need to get rid of. You took what you got from that solid food and what was left over. You don't want it to sit there. You want to get rid of it. The cell's the same way. It has solid things, or it has things that it creates, and it needs to remove those out of the inside of the cell, otherwise the cell gets too toxic. So all cells can perform exocytosis. It's most important in two types of cells: secretory cells, which include digestive enzymes, hormones, mucus, sweat, and mother's milk. Mother's milk is a form of exocytosis. Small cells produce little tiny amounts of mother's milk that all accumulate together to form the amount of milk that baby has when baby suckles. And then nerve cells, they secrete a chemical called a neurotransmitter. And without neurotransmitters, you're dead. Because nerves can't talk, and every function that you can ever possibly imagine can't happen anymore. Okay, moving right along. How's the pace today? Oh, we're going to be behind. Don't you worry. We'll get it all done. Not to worry. Where are we here? Okay. We're doing organelles of the cell. So, we had ourselves a membrane. Within that membrane, we got stuff on the inside. And a cell, as I said, is a kind of a mini-me of us. Remember, it's the basic unit of life, which means that a cell can breathe, eat, poop, pee, do all sorts of things, all things we do, only on a much smaller scale. So we have small organs, just like we do, we have organs in us, that are responsible for many things that occur within the cell. And because they're small, we call them organelles. So they're specialized structures within the cell. In other words, they're little organs. They can perform all sorts of things. Create proteins, package proteins, cause cellular growth, reproduction, and so forth. Each organelle uses its own internal chemical reactions to function properly, and each has their own specific enzymes. What are enzymes? Proteins. Remember, okay, I'm going to just keep bugging you about that. Everything's about proteins. Okay? The function of any particular organelle will influence and determine the type and amounts of organelles it will contain. So again, structure governs function. If a cell is expected to perform something more in this tissue or organ as compared to the cell over here, then maybe this cell has less mitochondria and more Golgi apparatus. And maybe this cell over here has more centrioles in it or whatever it might be. So again, when we look at diagrams that are drawn in textbooks, you know, the author or the artists give you the impression that every cell has lots of everything, and it doesn't, because it really depends on what that cell's functionally responsible for. Okay, so the first are called centrosomes and centrioles, right? These are we're going to talk a whole lot more about these when we're talking about mitosis. Everybody remembers what mitosis is? So we're talking about that as well, cell division. Okay? So the centrosome is a dense area of cytoplasmic material which sits close to the nucleus. What's cytoplasm? Correct. The sort of, yes, correct. So the cytosol is just a liquid. So the main component of the centrosome is a pair of centrioles which lie at right angles to each other with a pericentral matrix. So you can kind of see it. It's in this picture. Here we go. So we can see this pericentral matrix that completely surrounds these tubules, these microtubules that exist, right? So the main component of the centrosome is a pair of centrioles which lie at right angles to each other. And the centrioles are a tubular structure that has 27 microtubules arranged in 9 triplets arranged in a circular pattern. Okay? And look like that. Very specifically, they're in threes, and they completely surround in a circle in this configuration, lying at right angles to each other. Okay? The centrioles are surrounded, as I said, by this pericentral matrix, which contains hundreds of ring-like complexes made of a particular type of protein called tubulin. It is responsible for the growth of what is known as the mitotic spindle. So we have to remember, if you can recall, when you took mitosis, there was a point in cellular division where the chromosomes are pulled apart so that each daughter cell has a full complement of DNA. It is the reconfiguration of centrosomes and centrioles that pull the DNA apart so that each cell has a full complement of genetic material. Now, centrioles have their own DNA and are able to duplicate themselves. So we need to have that happen when we are doing cellular division. There is one centriole centrosome in a cell that is not dividing. But when a cell divides, it needs two, because we need genetic material pulled into cell A and genetic material pulled into cell B. Okay? And the DNA ensures that it can duplicate itself. During division, the centrosome coordinates the mitotic spindle, which will eventually help pull the cell's chromosomes to the opposite poles of the dividing cell. When the cell is not dividing, the centrosome acts as a coordination site for the microtubules. Sometimes it even acts as a little bit like an escalator, or through those tubes that move things very quickly along from one side of the cell to the other. Okay? These are these ones. Cilia and flagella, I don't spend a whole lot of time on them. They get a little more specific when we're looking at certain tissues, for example. So, these are motile tubes or hair-like structures. Okay? Cilia are short hair-like structures that extend from the surface of the extracellular membrane, and each cilia is anchored into the membrane. So in other words, there is a free end and an anchored end, just like the hair in your head, right? You've got one part of your hair anchored in your head, the other part flows everywhere, okay? It moves in an oar-like pattern. It has a stiff power stroke, and a loose return. So that return is known as a recovery stroke. So watch my hand. A stiff power stroke, and then a loose return. Now, that's important. So you hear me coughing. And you can probably tell I'm a little bit productive. You can, I've got a little bit of mucus I'm coughing up. So how the heck does that get up there? It's the cilia that is moving the mucus along. So that power stroke is pushing the mucus forward, and then when it relaxes, the mucus stays over here, and the cilia slips through, and then, and remember, you've got not just one cilia, you've got billions of them that are all lined up, and so they're moving and relaxing, moving and relaxing. And this is how you can get things up out of your lungs to get to a point where you can actively cough and then remove the rest of it after that. Anybody hear smoke? Did I ask that once before? Okay, so anybody here have anybody who's a heavy smoker in the family, grandfather, grandmother, whatever? So during the day, what do they sound like? Kinda. A little bit. Now, I was going to say, when they get out of bed, what's it like? Right. What's happening there? Tobacco paralyzes the cilia. So when you are a heavy smoker, all that guck sits in the lungs and festers and causes excessive inflammation. And then you go to bed at night and sleep and you don't smoke. And guess what happens? The cilia are no longer paralyzed and they move all that mucus to a point where the smoker hacks all that mucus up. And then what do they do? Light a smoke, it all gets paralyzed and the cough goes away. Do you vape nicotine? Yeah, probably. Yeah, because with everything goes now working and the cilia are moving all that guck out of the lungs to get rid of it. While you're smoking, it does. So while you have that active chemicals in the cigarette that you're smoking, it paralyzes the cilia. There's probably a particular link to it. I'm not sure. I only know that if they get up in the morning and they haven't smoked all night, that's why they cough, because the cilia are now functioning properly. Or other chemicals that are in the smoke itself. I don't think so. I think there's a chemical interaction between as the smoke passes through the respiratory tract and sticks to and affects the cilia as it's working its way down. You could. Secondhand smoke is actually worse than firsthand. Think about this. At what point did we decide to have a forest fire and stick your head over that fire on a Saturday night and go, okay, so I must confess, I was a two-pack of air. Long time, long, 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 long time ago. I think I had my first cigarette when I was 9. Yeah, my dad at a grocery store used to steal cigarettes from him. But again, that was just the way it was. And I also played varsity sports in high school while I smoked. Ran track, played varsity basketball. Guy Lafleur.
Oh, yeah.
Crazy, right? So, just think of that. It's the coordinated movement that causes fluid to move along the cell. So, again, that power stroke and that smooth recovery, and then power stroke is how everything gets moved. Yeah, because their mucus is so thick that the cilia isn't strong enough to move it. Yeah. Yeah, even when you have a really bad cold, like, you know, when you've got that really thick, yucky, rumbling kind of chest cold, and you can't get it out, it's because it's so sticky and so thick, the cilia isn't powerful enough to move that mucus along. Right, okay, that's possible. That's quite correct, yeah. For those without CF, we would just use a puffer, right? We'd get a puffer from our doctor, and that lowers the airways and smooths out the muscles, and we're able to get it a little bit better. Now, flagella is a bit different. It's similar, but it's longer. And it doesn't have a power stroke and a recovery stroke, right? It wiggles. Sperm. That's how sperm swim. They have a cell body that has all the things we're going to to talk about that's in any given cell, with a modification that has a very long flagella on the end, which allows it to swim, of course, where it wants to go, right, where it's meant to go to, so it's always moving forward. None. Now, you ladies do have cilia in your fallopian tubes, so that power stroke recovery is also used to move the ovum once it enters into the fallopian tube towards the uterus, right? Okay. So we can see here on the top left, this is cilia. So it's, you know, under the microscope, it's a lot more dense than I'm talking about with one hand moving things along. But you can see here, imagine you've got mucus that just kind of rolls along, working its way through the respiratory tract until eventually you expectorate it, however, you know, coughing or whatever it may be. And, of course, down here in the bottom, we can see flagella on the ends of the heads of the sperm. Almost as a coral, yeah. So, again, here we go. Here's our cilia with this power stroke recovery. And then we can see this whipping propeller-like movement that the flagellum does. And you may have seen these, again, in biology class in high school. There are many, many cells, single cells that do live in, you know, standing water and swamps and those sorts of things that do exist and swim around and so forth, right? The paramecium has, I believe it's cilia all the way around it that causes it to move and so forth. Ribosomes are another thing we can find there. These are the site of protein synthesis. They're small spherical organs. They do not have a membrane. Now, they are made up of two subunits. Now, when the ribosomes are not making proteins, those subunits are separate. When a cell is demanded to make a protein, okay, or proteins, depending on what's going on, those two subunits do come together to make a functional ribosome to create a protein, to create proteins. Okay, we're going to talk a whole lot about that, because that's one of my other favorite things is protein synthesis. Okay.
So you're saying that naturally in the cell they're separate.
They're somewhat separate. There's two subunits of ribosomes, and then when it's required that a ribosome needs to start making proteins, the two subunits will come together making a functional ribosome.
And then when they're no longer needed,
they separate again until later use when they're needed again.
Okay. So they're just always.
Yep. Yeah, we'll spend a whole lot of time on that. They can be free floating in the cell, so they can float in the cytosol. Or they're find attached to another organelle called the endoplasmic reticulum. So they can be free-floating or attached to the endoplasmic reticulum. Okay? So we can see here, here's our large subunit and our small subunit, and we will be spending time on this and the role they play in terms of making proteins. There are two main components. There's the ribosomal RNA and ribosomal proteins. So again, enzymes are required. If we're going to make proteins, it takes chemical reactions. We need enzymes in order for that to happen. The two compounds, the ribosomal RNA and the ribosomal protein, work together to form proteins along with other RNA and the right amino acids. And we will be discussing that in depth later. Yeah, it's not deoxy, it's ribo. But not to worry, just know it is RNA because we're going to spend time at that a little bit later. Free-floating ribosomes produce proteins that will be used in the cell, and those ribosomes that are attached to the endoplasmic reticulum, they're going to make proteins that leave the cell and go other places that are required, proteins that are required other places outside the cell. So free-floating for proteins inside the cell, attached ribosomes for proteins to be used outside the cell. So this is what you'll normally see as a drawing. And this is your microscopic drawing of what a ribosome actually looks like. So it's much more complicated than you would think. For our purposes, we're not going to get into it in that way. But you have to understand that that's kind of the two subunits. The gray is one subunit and the blue is another. And they do come together to become a functional ribosome when we're producing proteins. All right? So I said if ribosomes are attached to the endoplasmic reticulum, they create proteins leaving the cell. So since we've talked about ribosomes, then our next organelle is called the endoplasmic reticulum. This organelle is a network of tubules or flattened sacs, vesicles, and they are interconnected. The walls of the tubules and vesicles are a bilipid layer, just like we talked about here when we were looking at the cell membrane itself. The membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum is continuous or connected to the nuclear envelope. So we can see here we have a membrane that surrounds the nucleus, and that is known as the nuclear envelope. And we can see that the endoplasmic reticulum is continuous with this nuclear envelope. And here we can see these little tiny dots on the endoplasmic reticulum, and those are all ribosomes that are attached to it, of course, that are going to make proteins that will leave the cell. Remember, free-floating make proteins in the cell, and those attached make proteins that go outside the cell. Now, you saw that there were cavities between these walls, and there is a special fluid matrix, and it is continuous, this fluid matrix, with the space between the double nuclear envelope of the nucleus. Because of its convoluted nature, it has a very large surface area, basically 30 to 40 times that of the membrane, the cell membrane it actually sits in. Whenever you see convolutions, whenever something's folded in and folded in and folded in and folded in, it is an attempt in the human body to take a large surface area, say the size of this room, every wall in this room, and how big the surface area is, and by doing the origami, can I have that? Put it in a size that big and have the same surface area. Okay? So the whole surface area of this room in this little container, and the body does that by folding or convoluting those structures. So we can see here in the diagram, see it's all folded in on itself, thus increasing and increasing and increasing surface area that allows for more and more of the process to occur. Does that make sense, everybody? Because we're going to... There's all kinds of areas where you're going to see modifications to increase surface area to have more and more and more interaction. That's right. So it's a way of putting it in. So we have this. You can see that we have the nuclear envelope. We can see that there's a space in here which would have a fluid in it. And there's also continuing fluid in these spaces of the endoplasmic reticulum. We can see it there sort of standing alone, and it all kind of is interacted. And in a moment, I'll tell you why. This is a bit of a different drawing. It might make a little more sense. Here we can see the nuclear envelope is in purple with these, again, ribosomes on it. But you'll note that there's big, big holes in that nuclear envelope, and we're going to get back to those in a while. All these ribosomes are attached to all these folded convolutions of the endoplasmic reticulum. And because there's ribosomes on it, it looks rough or spotted. It's called the rough endoplasmic reticulum. So the rough endoplasmic reticulum works very closely with the Golgi apparatus forming and packaging compounds. The smooth endoplasmic... Did I miss a slide here? I must have. Right, I missed a slide here. So, segments of the endoplasmic reticulum have small granules called ribosomes attached to the surface. Where the ribosomes are attached to the endoplasmic reticulum, this is known as the rough or granular endoplasmic reticulum. The areas without ribosomes are called the smooth or agranular endoplasmic reticulum. The rough endoplasmic reticulum is the area where some proteins are formed and enter into the endoplasmic reticulum spaces to be processed and sorted. There is also here that the rough endoplasmic reticulum also helps add carbohydrates to proteins to form those glycoproteins to replace the ones that get broken in the cell membrane. Correct. So, the rough endoplasmic reticulum works closely with the Golgi apparatus, which is another organelle we're going to talk about, in forming and packaging compounds. The smooth is the area where lipids such as steroids, estrogens for ladies, testosterone for traditional men. By the way, when I say that, please understand that I know the world that we live in today, that there is fluidity in gender. When we talk from a science perspective, I'm going to be talking from the perspective of genetics, right? That, you know, traditionally we find higher levels of estrogen in what we call female, and we have higher levels of testosterone, what we call males. So please do not be offended if I sort of use those scientific terms from that scientific perspective, with the understanding that I know that gender is fluid and that I respect that, but we're talking more here at a bit of more science level, okay? The smooth end of glycosylation is where lipids such as steroids, estrogens, and testosterone, fatty acid, and phospholipids are formed. Fatty acids and phospholipids form the cell membrane. Right. It also stores and forms enzymes which help detoxify some chemicals such as alcohol and carcinogens. What are carcinogens? Things that cause cancer. Right. Some of those chemicals that, you know, we hear about in the news every once in a while, but, you know, chocolate now causes cancer, or God knows what. What is it? smooth endoplasmic reticulum and rough endoplasmic reticulum act as transport channels to help various compounds access various parts of the cell. So we can see here, here is our nucleus here in purple. Here's our nuclear envelope in green. We can see this continuation of the fluid around the nucleus will continue into and fill up the cisterns of the endoplasmic reticulum. And because we have ribosomes here, this is the rough endoplasmic reticulum. And we can see there are no ribosomes here. So this is known as the smooth. And of course, as we know, endoplasmic reticulum is responsible, or sorry, the ribosomes are responsible for creating proteins. Everything's proteins. Trust me, you're going to get sick of it because you won't believe how much proteins is everything in the human body, like everything. All right, so let's have a look here at this picture. You know, you can write this down or you can just listen because I will talk about it later. We said the nuclear envelope is continuous with the endoplasmic reticulum. And then we also said that the opening, it opens into the endoplasmic reticulum from the nuclear envelope, and that the nucleus sits in the nuclear envelope in a fluid. Why? Why would we have such an intimate connection between the nuclear envelope, the nucleus, and the endoplasmic reticulum, especially rough, with ribosomes and great proteins? Yes. And what's it making? Proteins. Okay, so I want you to start thinking of it this way. Does everybody know who Julia Child is? Okay, think of your famous cook. Does anybody here have a favorite cook? Right, think of a cookbook. So what is in the nucleus? What is the nucleus made of? I don't know, you know. DNA is what? Chromosomes. Right. And what are chromosomes? What are they? They're your genes. And what does your genes create? Like what? Eye color, hair color, size of your lips, height. You know, it's why, you know, you can be in town, someone looks at you and goes, hey, you look just like a blah, blah, blah. Are you related to blah, blah, blah? Well, yes, I am, right? Because genetics involve what you look like. So what does that mean? So when we look at genetic material and genes, genes are a recipe. So we're going to turn to page 322 in our cookbook and make chocolate cake, right? We're making chocolate cake. So to make chocolate cake, what do you need? Sorry? Great. Could be anything. Sugar, flour, chocolate, fat of some kind, whatever it is, and on and on and on to make your chocolate cake. Genes are a recipe to create a protein which influences the color of your eyes, the color of your hair, and so on and so forth. It's all about proteins. So your genetic material is a recipe book for creating proteins. So if the genetic material found in the nucleus sits in the envelope and the ribosomes are responsible for creating said protein, now we have a mechanism by which the message from the nucleus to say, we need chocolate cake today. We make a copy of the recipe of the chocolate cake. A recipe goes out, and through the interaction of RNA and ribosomes, we put amino acids together to eventually create chocolate cake. Everybody follow? So that's exactly what happens. But that? No, it's more like a biological photocopier that comes up with a mensual kind of 3D whatever. Okay? So that's why there's such an intimate relationship between the nucleus and the endoplasmic reticulum. Okay? Because, especially the rough, because you're going to discover that the genetic material that's in the nucleus can't come out. In the microscopic world, it's unbelievably massive, the molecule. A gene is an unbelievably massive molecule. It can't leave the nucleus. We don't want it to anyways. We want to be able to use it again and again and again and again. And if it needs the nucleus and it starts banging around, well, all of a sudden the potential for mutation and not going, same thing's not going well is not very good. So we need to take a photocopy, if you want to call it that, or a copy of the gene, and then it leaves the nucleus, and it uses a process by which those ribosomes attached to the endoplasmic reticulum will stick amino acids together and together and together and together and together until you maybe get 1,000 all stuck together, but you still don't have a protein. Because the next thing that has to happen is the next organelle we'll talk about next week, and that's called the Golgi apparatus. Now, the Golgi apparatus takes that long string of amino acids and puts an origami on it and folds it, because the string of amino acids has to be folded before it becomes a functional protein. But that's for another day when we talk about proteins. But please understand that this is the reason why there's such a connection between the nuclear envelope and the cisternal spaces and the convolutions of the endoplasmic reticulum, because of the significant intimate relationship between the nucleus and the endoplasmic reticulum to create the multitudes of proteins that your genes can create for everything. Okay? See you next week. Are we a test next week? Or a quiz? I think it's a test next week, isn't it? Okay. Everything up to where we just finished today. We'll catch up. I know. I think what I'll do is I'll just make it, give you 7 and make it your best 4 of 7. Rather than 4 than 8. Oh, wait, I can do that. Thursday, no, you have a quiz. You still have a quiz with me in the other class. Yeah. The quiz you missed? No. No, it's getting tossed out, and you're going to have 7 quizzes, and I'll take your best 4. Is there a test next week or a quiz? Who has a syllabus? Then it's a quiz. No, forget about last week's quiz. Take it out of your mind. It's not going to happen. Okay? The quiz on Thursday. Oh, okay. Sorry, we're in A&P, and I'm like, what's going on here? What? Sorry. Okay.